I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, greatest state in the land of the free, raised in the woods so he knew every tree, killed him a bar when he was only three.
Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
Yes, today we are talking about Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier. And this has a unique little bit of a history. What's that term you like to use, Kiki? Movie loaf?
Movie loaf. We got us another one.
Let's explain what that is quickly for some for people who may not be familiar with the term.
I got the term from Mystery Science Theater when they say that this is not so much a single coherent movie as it is bits and pieces of movie chopped and formed to create a movie loaf. And that's kind of what this is, because it started out as individual episodes in a miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
And then, much like when we talked about the Zorro movie, they just took these episodes, edited them down, added a few musical transitions, and shoved them all together as if it was a film.
Walt had always loved American history. It's one of the cornerstones of the creation of the Disneyland park, Frontierland especially. So he wanted to do a Frontierland special. The first episode, Davy Crockett, pardon the wording here, Indian Fighter, aired in December of 1954. The second episode, Davy Crockett Goes to Congress, aired in January of 1955. And the third episode, Davy Crockett at the Alamo, aired in February of 1955. And the popularity of these three specials blew up immensely, as seemingly overnight, Davy Crockett was everywhere. And Disney capitalized on this with Davy Crockett merchandise up the wazoo. Look at any picture from this era of time, and you will see at least one kid wearing a coonskin cap.
Yeah, this was one of Disney's first big marketing successes.
And it showed the success of television in terms of marketing.
Yeah, as in, this was a merchandising tie-in coup for Disney. And not to say that there hadn't been tie-in merchandise, of course, before. But now we think of, like, you know, what are the big toys that kids demand, you know, during our lifetimes. You know, we had a run on like Cabbage Patch Babies when I was a kid, the Tickle Me Elmo craze, you know, that caused like actual fist fights in stores and stuff. Basically, in 1955, every boy wanted a coonskin cap and you know, a toy rifle and, you know, all the stuff that was in with Davy Crockett.
If you ever seen, like, Back to the Future, that's why the Ballad of Davy Crockett is playing at the diner when Marty gets in. That's how big and culturally relevant Davy Crockett was. Lorraine's brother, I believe, is actually wearing a coonskin cap while they're watching The Honeymooners, I believe.
Yeah, and the song was a massive success as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that song was everywhere. It was a massive selling album. It also was imported to, you know, other countries to promote the movie, because, you know, people in England aren't really going to know who Davy Crockett is. So before releasing the movie over there, they sent the song over there to be like a catchy thing of like, hey, don't you want to know more about this guy? Oh, yeah. Now you can go see a movie about him. It even showed up in politics. A senator from Tennessee in his 1956 campaign, he was the Democratic vice presidential nominee. He wore a coonskin cap on the campaign trail to draw a connection between Davey and himself. So
yeah, the popularity of the series grew so big that they released this into theaters. May 1955, the three episodes I just talked about were edited and released as a film. Luckily, they filmed this thing in color, which says a lot that they decided to film what was originally intended to be a TV special in color in the era of black and white television.
And honestly, one of the things that we made note of in my house while watching it is how good this movie looks on Disney Plus.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that was filmed in the 1950s for television, and it looks brilliant on a 4K TV. So I don't know what they've put into it to restore it and, you know, bring it, but it looks amazing.
All right, so yeah, and the popularity of Davy Crockett led them to create more. In the fall of 1955, two more specials were created. Davy Crockett's Keelboat Race in November of 55, and Davy Crockett and the River Pirates in December of 55, and those two were also released as a film. Crockett Mania was running wild.
Yeah, and this really was the big thing. Like I said, you know, this is my father's era, and he was also big into like westerns and frontier stories and stuff like that, and he was huge into Davy Crockett when he was a kid. So he was exactly at that age of young boy that this was targeted toward.
And for a movie that essentially was aimed at young boys, this movie doesn't pull a lot of punches. Yes, it sugarcoats a lot of history, but it shows a little bit of the reality of history.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that the way it sugarcoats it is kind of more how most Americans would sugarcoat our history at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it was really sugar-coated because this is for kids so much as this is for America.
So, yeah, I mean, they go into some really deep themes in here, and it shows, which honestly led to a little bit of a controversy in this movie. There were people who, even at the time this movie was out, were questioning, should Davy Crockett be this celebrated, or how historically accurate is this movie?
This is a really, really interesting film to me, and honestly, I've got more to say once we start dissecting the plot here. You want to get into who's in this movie so we can get to that plot?
Sure, let's get into the cast here.
All right. As Davy Crockett himself, we have Fess Parker. He was primarily known for two things. He seemed to have kind of an interesting niche. Davy Crockett was the first one. He did that for Disney and ABC. At the time, ABC was not owned by Disney, of course, but they've had a partnership way back. And after he did Davy Crockett, he would go on to portray another great American folk hero, Daniel Boone. For NBC.
Daniel Boone was a man, yes, a big man, with an eye like an eagle and as tall as a mountain was he.
In fact, a lot of people that show up in this Davy Crockett movie would show up again on Daniel Boone. He also was in Old Yeller for Disney. He worked with Disney for a while, those are his big roles that he did for Disney, but he did a lot of other stuff, especially westerns that Disney was producing at the time. But he and Walt kind of had a bit of a falling out. Fess Parker basically said, I'm playing the same role for you in every movie. Disney did not want him to taint the persona they had built around him. They would not lend him out for films, which was the common practice at the time. And so as long as he was under contract with Disney, he was not able to go be in other movies. He was offered a part in a major John Wayne movie. He was offered parts opposite Marilyn Monroe. And Walt said, nope, can't do it. And then eventually it got so contentious that Walt was like, for your next movie, you're just going to play this bit part in something that I'm creating. A film called Tonka, another Western. But Fess Parker, like I said, huge star for Disney, was given like this bit part. And he refused to do that, which was a breach of contract. So they put him on suspension and refused to cast him in anything. And eventually he left. And then after that, he went on to do some other films, some other TV, eventually ending up as Daniel Boone on NBC. But probably better remembered for Davy Crockett than for Daniel Boone, to be honest. That seems to have survived the test of time a little bit better.
From Crockett to Boone, it's a lateral move at best, honestly.
Well, that's the irony, is that he left Disney because they were typecasting him, and after he left Disney, pretty much all of his parts are that Davy Crockett typecast. So he wasn't able to escape it even after leaving Disney. So all right, as Davy sidekick here, George Georgie Russell, we have the legendary Buddy Ebsen. You will know Buddy Ebsen either as Jed Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Come and listen to a story about a man named Jed. A poor mountaineer barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up to the ground come a bubbling crude. Oil, that is, black gold, Texas tea.
Or you will know him as Barnaby Jones in Barnaby Jones. Absolutely legendary television actor, of course. But he had a long film career. We've talked about Buddy Ebsen before, kind of in passing, when we talked about Ray Bolger. Because Buddy Ebsen was originally supposed to be the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. The problem is, he was deathly allergic to the makeup that they were using. It had aluminum dust in it, and he ended up inhaling a bunch of it, and ended up in the hospital with lung problems, and also kind of systemic reaction to it, and they finally figured out, like, oh, oops, he's allergic to it, and if he goes back to playing this part, he will die. So they replaced him with Ray Bolger. Interestingly, he had a bit of a history with Disney, which is that Disney used Buddy Ebsen as a animation reference. They filmed him dancing, and they turned it into a dance that Mickey Mouse does in some of the really early shorts. After a stint where he went off and served in the Coast Guard during World War II, he completed his service honorably and came back to Hollywood. And he came back to Disney, and Disney said, we're planning this TV show about Davy Crockett, and we want you to play the part of Davy Crockett. That's right, Buddy Ebsen was supposed to be Davy Crockett. And they were gearing up, you know, they'd already hired him for it. And then Walt went to go see a little horror movie called Them, which had Fess Parker in the role there. And he apparently turned to someone in the theater and said, "That's my Davy Crockett." And Buddy Ebsen lost yet another job. Buddy Ebsen did not have the greatest of luck, it's all I'm saying. Instead of just, you know, shunting him from the project entirely, they moved him down to spot number two and gave him the part of Georgie Russell. And interestingly, that was a really, really good move for Ebsen because it really gave him national exposure finally. And his career started taking off after that. So, he got a lot of parts based on that. And he ended up, making the move again from, TV. He did a lot of TV and then he ended up in, Breakfast at Tiffany's. He is the husband that Audrey Hepburn deserts to go have fun in New York. And then shortly after Breakfast at Tiffany's, he got another television role, and that became the Beverly Hillbillies. And from then on, he was one of the biggest stars in America because Beverly Hillbillies was still like top 10 television when it got canceled. So, I mean, this was one of those shows that it didn't really flag. People were still watching it up until the point where the network canned it. And then not long after that show was canceled, he went into another long-running series as Barnaby Jones, a detective series. And that was also one of the biggest things in the nation. So, all through the kind of 60s and 70s, Buddy Ebsen was like the biggest thing on television. So those are our two big stars, but we do have some interesting people of note rounding out the cast. So to go through them quickly, we've talked about him before, but Hans Conried, who is the voice of Captain Hook in Peter Pan, and also Snidely Whiplash over working for another company there. He is in this film as the kind of weird gambler that ends up going to the Battle of the Alamo with Davy and Georgie. Thimble Rig is his character's name. I don't know that that character has any basis in history, but he's kind of here for a bit of comic relief. But we've talked about him before when we talked about Peter Pan. So, as general and then president Andrew Jackson, we have Basil Ruysdale. He was an actor and an opera singer. And also, strangely, much like Hans Conried, was a vocal coach to other people. Hans Conried did it for elocution, for pronunciation and to erase features of accents to make you more clear on camera and stuff like that. Ruysdale was more of a singing vocal coach. His last film role was in 101 Dalmatians. As our, I hate to say the bad guy of the first act, but he really is, Chief Redstick of the Creek tribe, I believe, we have Pat Hogan. Pat Hogan was Native American. He was a member of the Oneida tribe. Pretty much his entire career was playing Native parts. So he was in this, of course, but he also was in, like, Gunsmoke and The Rifleman. He shows up in Daniel Boone again, because most of this cast does. So he worked steadily Basically, up until his death, he died in 1966. So the other person who played a native that actually gets a name in this film was not native. He was of Italian descent. And that's a really interesting part of Hollywood history, is that so many actors who played Native American parts in Westerns at this time were actually Italian descent. Yeah, but Nick Cravat as Busted Luck.
The mute Native American that they befriend towards the end of the movie.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is the reason he's mute is because Nick Cravat had a really thick Brooklyn accent. So most of the characters he played were mute because of this. He had the right look, according to the casting director, but he didn't have the voice for it. Possibly the most famous character you've ever seen him play is a little episode of Twilight Zone where William Shatner screams about, "There's a thing on the wing." He was the thing on the wing. He's the gremlin on the wing of the aircraft in Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. So yeah, that's, you know him from that famous thing. He's hidden under all the makeup, playing opposite William Shatner there, but that's where you know him from. He's in this movie. So, a couple of other, real quick, we have, playing James Bowie, we have Kenneth Toby. Kenneth Toby, again, kind of, a person who ended up in a lot of Westerns at this time. But also, interestingly, a lot of sci-fi movies in the 50s. He ended up as well in Daniel Boone. Because everybody in this movie also ended up in Daniel Boone. And ended up having a career pretty much up until he died in 2002. One of the most interesting things to me is that he's in an episode of Deep Space Nine called Shadow Play, where he plays a man who recreates his village and family as holograms. And the projectors for the holograms start breaking down, and they suddenly realize the entire town is holographic except him. That was one of his later film roles, but that was him. And last person we're going to talk about just in passing, as Davy Crockett's wife, Polly Crockett, we have Helene Stanley. And we've talked about her before because she was the live-action model that they used for animation reference for Cinderella, Princess Aurora, and also Anita Radcliffe from 101 Dalmatians. So she was kind of the movement and body behind a lot of early Disney animation there. And she's in this for a shockingly brief time.
Yeah, only in the first act, really.
Yeah. So let's get into that plot there, because there is some interesting stuff to talk about here.
All right, so before we even start this movie, there's a big thank you from Disney to the Cherokee Nation for the help on this movie.
Yeah, and also interestingly, this is one of the films that gets the Disney "Oops, we did a racism" warning.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that big wall of text that it was wrong then and wrong now to the portrayal of Native Americans in this movie.
And that's a more complex topic than that disclaimer would suggest. So we're going to get into that as we talk about the plot, as the plot unfolds, because it's really kind of fascinating. But the first third of the movie, because we're basically in thirds here, and each one is a separate vignette from the life of Davy Crockett, and the first one is about the Creek Indian Wars.
Yep. There's a nice little framing device here of all of these coming directly from Crockett's journal. So, I mean, that actually is a nice little, even for a film to kind of, explain where all these stories are coming from.
Yeah, and I really hope you like that Davy Crockett song, because you're going to hear it over and over and over. They frame the beginning and end of every section with that song kind of either telling you what you're about to see or summing up action that takes place between the episodes.
And the scenes that they cut for the film version.
Yeah. There's a lot of exposition that gets put in those little stings of the song.
Someone actually put together all those little pieces. The official released version of the song is about 2.5 minutes. The full version is about 8.
Yeah, this movie is just full of that song. And I assume the other movie, the River Pirates movie, probably uses the same device.
All right, so we are here at the Creek War around 1814. Crockett here is a volunteer soldier, so he's not a proper soldier with a uniform or anything. And the soldiers, including Andrew Jackson here, are wondering where Crockett's at, and they explain that he's grinning down a bear, which involves him smiling at an animal until the animal gives up.
Yeah, the thing is that they show it kind of later in the film, but Davy Crockett really did have all these really bizarre folk tales about him even during his life. And this was one of them that he was so mesmerizing. He could just smile and a bear would just give up. File that under things that definitely happened, I guess, is all we gotta say.
This is like the original Norse facts or something like that.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. However, it shows that the American soldiers are rather incompetent compared to the scrappy settler nature of Davy and Georgie. And they mess up his grinning down the bear, so he has to just pull out his knife and fight hand-to-hand with the bear.
I see it more of the soldiers are more brutish, and Davy is kind of more, I guess, creative in his fighting style.
Well, today we would do the thing of, like, street smarts or
yeah,
whatever.
I was going to say that, but that really wasn't a thing back then.
Yeah, but it's the same kind of idea, is that you have the soldiers that are like, you know, town folk who are really educated and everything, but Davy's the one that knows the land and the people and the animals and the, you know. That comes up several times when he asks the soldiers, like, can you do a hoot owl? And he does a bad impression of an owl, and he's like, oh yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah. So what does soon-to-be President Jackson want Crockett to do is to join the soldiers to go after the Creek tribe. And Crockett wants to stay hidden. But the soldiers want to take the path and go the direct route, which goes as well as you'd expect.
Yeah, and interestingly, there is historical basis in this. The difference in fighting style between the kind of standing army and the way that the natives fought, which was using the trees, a lot of stealth, a lot of cover, they kind of turn it into an interesting bit here, because while the natives are portrayed, you know, the Creek are kind of portrayed as the bad guys in this first one. Like, we're not supposed to feel bad when the soldiers go in and ambush a group that's around a fire getting prepared for battle, because we're told that they're doing war dances and they're preparing to go to battle, and the soldiers just want to get there first. While we're not supposed to feel bad for kind of all of the natives they massacre in this this first part, there is an interesting bit where you start to see Davy realize that the natives have a better way of fighting and that they're worth learning from and mimicking a little bit because they're better in touch with the surroundings, you know, with the terrain and all that, and that their style of fighting is smarter for where they are. You know, they're not in a big battlefield where you can just have two armies come across, which was the more European way, but, you know, they're in the middle of the woods in this and the mountains. And so that style of fighting is better suited for that. And you see Davy starting to realize it, which is our first hint that everything might not be as cut and dry as you would expect in a Western.
To kind of skip ahead in a bit, we see that Crockett, at least this interpretation of Crockett, doesn't find joy in shooting the natives. He specifically stresses that there can be a peace. You know, we can have a peace treaty. You can keep your land. We can all live peacefully together. While the Creeks are upset that the white man is on their land, the white man just wants to expand. And Crockett seems to be the middleman in both of those points of view.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is at various points throughout the story, you see both sides of this. You see that Davy is just a guy that's trying to settle on some land and raise a family.
Yeah, he wants to raise a family.
And that the only reason he went to volunteer is because the peace of the settlement where he was threatened by this war. So he wanted to see an end to this war so his family would be safe. But while he does seem to have respect for Andrew Jackson at this point, he's also not afraid to stand up to him and say, like, we need to be working with the chiefs of these various tribes to get a peace. And eventually they get a peace with every chief except for Chief Red Stick. Who was an actual guy. I mean, this is a historical event. More or less. I mean, you know, how much Davy actually had to do with this battle and stuff is a bit, you know, up for debate. You know, Jackson wants him to go and hunt down Red Stick, and you can see Davy is not really into that. Jackson is very much, we have to hunt down all the natives and crush them. And if you know anything about Andrew Jackson, you know where we're going with this. But Davy is like, no, the danger is over for now from encroaching, you know, war parties. I need to go home to my family and make sure they have food to get them through the winter. So, see ya.
Yeah, Crockett specifically says, I'm a volunteer, and my volunteer status ended after 60 days, and it's been past 60 days. I'll come back and hunt down Red Stick, but I need to prepare first. If you go in, especially if they go in blind, they're going to be ambushed.
Yeah, but also he is very concerned about his family. He's like, you know what, all these petty territory squabbles can wait. Right now, the winter is more of a danger to my family than the native raiding parties are.
So after all of this, we go to... Well, before we get there, we see that Georgie has at least saved Crockett's life in this skirmish, in the previous skirmish with the Creek tribe, and says, hey, my wife owes you a kiss for that. And as soon as they get home, Georgie is all about shoving that tongue down Mrs. Crockett's throat.
Yeah. We also get a part kind of in this little interlude that will come back later when Mrs. Crockett mentions that Georgie has been writing songs about Davy and his travels with Davy. And that becomes important kind of later on in the story. But we get some time back home with Davy. We see what he's giving up to go out and fight these battles. His absolutely gorgeous wife and her perfectly manicured nails.
For the 1800s.
I mean, they are gorgeous, let me tell you.
Gotta go to those 1800 salons, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad she's able to get to the salon every week to get her mani-pedi. But, yeah, and he's got two boys, I think we see at this point, that are at home on the homestead. She basically begs him not to go back. You know, I want you to stay with me. I want you to settle down. And he tells her that all of this is so they can settle down. This is not where he wants to end up. He wants to eventually go further out west to some new territory and find them a bigger chunk of land where they can have like a real proper farm in good farmland, because right now they're in the mountains and the farming's not as good. So that's his eventual plan. I'm gonna do some more fighting for my government. Then I'm gonna go get us a piece of land out in some of the new territories that have just opened up, and we're gonna move the whole family out there, and we're gonna be farmers, and it's gonna be peaceful and wonderful and heavenly.
It's a nice dream to have. Let's see if it turns out well for Mr. Crockett. So, after settling with his wife and making sure they have enough food to get him through the winter, he very easily finds the army again because they're not subtle. No. Dead
the
men,
army is not
dead
stealthy
horse,
at all.
Dead horses, lame horses, dead men, sick men. They are literally littering the West here with their soldiers.
And Davy shows back up and he's like, oh yeah, it looks like you're having a horrible time with this war you're fighting. Why don't I go find Chief Red Stick and try to negotiate a peace? And at this point, Andrew Jax is like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, we are getting stomped, so yeah.
And also, they're getting sick.
A lot of disease running through the camps, as, you know, historically accurate as well. So he was like, you know what, I'm never going to find Red Stick and be able to talk to him if I take all of your inept soldiers with me. So me and Georgie are going to go out and look for him, and we'll come back to you.
And as they're doing this, Georgie gets captured.
Yep, Georgie gets captured, and apparently their plan is to burn him at the stake. This leads to one of the funniest scenes in the whole thing to me, where Davy walks up and he's like, I come in peace, I just want to talk. And like, one of the natives takes a step forward and he just throws a dagger right into the guy's heart and kills him instantly. And then he's like, now do you want to talk to me? And I'm like, what a way to show that you come in peace, dude. Like, just murder one of their guys.
Yeah. It's like, if he had just not jumped at him or stepped forward to him, he would have still be alive.
But the thing is that his motion, like, while he is stepping forward and while it is kind of a aggressive posture, it's not like, you know, some movies would be like, oh, he finds kind of a sniper hidden in the tree line who's about to shoot an arrow at him or something, and he takes him out first. Like, I'm not even sure the guy had a weapon in his hand when he stepped forward. It was just more like, hey, what do you think you're doing here? You know? It's
like... So, yeah, yeah. So Red Stick says, why should we listen to you? You hunt us. And he says, well, only because you started the conflict. Whether that's true or not.
Yeah, I mean, historically. But from Davy's perspective at this point, that's what he thinks happened. And he tells Red Stick, like, hey, every other chief has signed the peace treaty. The government is willing to let you go back and live in peace on your own land. If you'll just sign the peace treaty. And Red Stick's like, you know what? I'd rather just murder a white man.
He even appeals to them, you know, how many children don't have a father anymore? How many women don't have a husband anymore? And Red Stick just turns to me, you're talking like a woman. He says, he's trying to talk peace.
Yeah, and Red Stick is very much portrayed as, I am a warrior and I want to keep fighting.
Eventually, Red Stick and Crockett come to an agreement that they will have a one-on-one fight. And if Crockett wins, then they'll sign the peace treaty. And they go with a tomahawk fight, where they're holding tomahawks in each hand, going after each other in this wrestling match, I guess.
Yeah, and Red Stick ends up cheating at one point. At one point, he and Davey are both disarmed, and one of his warriors hands him another tomahawk. You know, once again, Red Stick is really portrayed as the definitive bad guy in this part. But in a very bizarre and badly choreographed move, Davey gets the upper hand and says to Red Stick that he will agree not to kill him as long as he agrees to sign the peace treaty and just go home. And Red Stick's like, well, you beat me in a fair duel. Okay, fine. We'll do it your way.
He even says, you know, why didn't you kill me? And it's a weird way they go about it, but it says, well, there's another rule that the white man follow. We haven't been following it lately, but it says, thou shalt not kill. Hell of a time to bring that up, Davey.
But, you know, he promises them that the American government is honorable, and white men have laws, and they will honor their peace treaties.
And that technically ends the first segment of the movie, the Creek War part, the first part of the miniseries.
And now Davey's going back to the homestead. He's going on the... Yeah, this is literally how everything just kind of transitions. Like, it'll get to a point where you'd be like, oh, that's a commercial break, and then we'll just get the Wellington singing group coming in telling us what's happened in the interstitial before the next episode.
So yeah, in this next segment, Crockett's back home. He's with his family, he's with his boys, but he's overheard that there's some territory up in Tennessee that is up for purchase, and him and Georgie are going to go to Tennessee and get that land, settle on it, you know, send for the wife and kids, and that's where he's going to settle down. Travel by map to Tennessee, and Crockett is all set to buy the land, but the land apparently has already been bought by a very large man called Bigfoot Mason. And that if he wants the land, he's going to have to beat Bigfoot Mason in a contest. And apparently, no one wants to sign Davy Crockett to this contest because Bigfoot never loses.
Yeah, and we kind of see a bit about, like, he uses his own men to judge the contest and everything. And there's this little lawyer guy that keeps going, like, you know, this isn't, you're not running it correctly. You're not, you know, Mason is used to just running over people and doing whatever he wants. It's pretty obvious. And Davey comes up and he's like, hey, I'll stake $15, so, you know, a massive sum of money at that time, to buy my way into your shooting contest. You know, if I win, I get the land. If you win, you get the $15.
Timeline-wise, this is around 1820. The film makes it feel like this all happened in one go, but we are jumping the timeline a bit in these segments.
Yeah, these are all points scattered throughout the life of Davy Crockett. So we got like a pretty good 20-year time span of the events in this movie. So
yeah, they each have a shooting contest to see, and they're both pretty excellent shots. Eventually, Crockett wins the shootout by shooting not only his own bullet, but Bigfoot's bullet straight through the target.
He's able to put a bullet in the same hole as his previous bullet, and, you know, that's, of course, proves him the better shot. He wins the contest, and Bigfoot is not happy about this. But the lawyer draws up all the papers and says, here's your chunk of land. You've got one neighbor who is a family of Cherokee. Charlie Two Shirts, and his family. It says that's your neighbor. And Davy, again, we're seeing an interesting side of Davy, because Davy doesn't go like, oh, a Cherokee family or my neighbors, I guess I better get my gun handy. He just goes like, oh, cool, I'll have to go over and introduce myself and meet the wife and kids, and that'll be great. So we again see that Davy doesn't have any particular prejudice against the natives. He fought to protect his land, but that was it. Once his family was safe, he didn't want to keep fighting. He finds out from the lawyer that Bigfoot and his friends have been breaking the treaty with the Cherokee and taking their land and running them off of it with violence if necessary in order to steal the land and resell it to white people.
Yep, he goes to Charlie Two Shirts. He sees their family cowering.
And Charlie's been beaten badly. The one thing that we neglected to mention just then is that the lawyer tells Davy that the really fancy gun that Bigfoot was using in the contest, which Davy made note of earlier in the scene, was actually belonged to a magistrate that had come to the area to get Bigfoot and his, you know, squad of guys to stop harassing the natives. That magistrate disappeared, but his really fancy, expensive gun did not. So it's pretty clear that Bigfoot and his goons killed the magistrate, and therefore a really violent threat to everyone around.
And the lawyer even asked Davy if he wants the job as magistrate.
Because Davy has already become famous at this point, to some extent, because the lawyer has heard of him. When he hears Davy's name, when he sees Davy's signature on the papers, he's like, oh my goodness, you're that Davy Crockett? Well, you know, good grief. So we know that Davy already has a little bit of a legend behind him at this point for what he did in the Creek War.
So yeah, he sees Charlie Two Shirts beaten, bloody, even, and Charlie says, hey, these white men came in here saying, natives don't own land, natives don't deserve land, ripped up my deed, I told him I bought this land myself. So he decides that this is when Crockett decides that, he's gonna take that job as magistrate.
Yeah, so him and Georgie and Charlie, you know, they grab their rifles and they go knock on Bigfoot's door.
So yeah, they're gonna settle this, and even letting, Bigfoot set the terms of it. And it's going to be a fight, a fist fight, no holds barred, live out this Sunday, Crockett. Sorry.
Yeah.
So yeah, the two pretty much have a fist fight with no rules, and that does come into play as Bigfoot's posse starts to cheat in favor of Bigfoot. But Georgie and Charlie even the odds and make sure that Bigfoot's men don't interfere in the fight.
Even straight up murdering one of them.
Because he was going to shoot Davy.
Well, he was going to shoot Davy. I mean, it was self-defense, but one of Bigfoot's guys does die in this skirmish. But Davy gets the upper hand and tells Bigfoot, I'm not going to kill you, but I'm going to take you in, and you and your guys are going to be put in front of a judge for all the stuff you've done.
So yeah, that ends Bigfoot's tirade for now. He is mentioned later on.
Yeah.
So there's a nice little party going on that the people are now feel safer now that Bigfoot is behind bars, and Georgie starts dancing with some girls. That's a running gag in the movie that Georgie cannot get a girl. This is where things start to fall for Mr. Crockett as he gets a letter from back home.
And apparently it took a month for it to be delivered because Georgie makes a joke about how quick it was, which honestly at this point that would have been pretty fast to get the mail. And he's like, you know, hey, it's a letter and it's only a month, you know, a month to get here, so you know, it's breaking news.
And it's the letter is from Davy's sister-in-law, the wife of his brother. And apparently Davy's wife has been sick and passed away. The boys are going to be living with Davy's brother for a while, but because they need a mother and a father for right now. But at this point, Davy is just broken. The entire reason he came to Tennessee was to give his family a better life. To have this homestead, this farm with his wife, and that's gone.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the farm now, but he doesn't have the wife, and his children are living with someone else. This is basically the last we hear of Davy Crockett, family man, in this movie. It is awkward.
Quickly, things change as the town wants Crockett to become a politician, kind of be their representative.
And he's like, well, I'm not sure. And they're like, well, there's this corrupt guy that's trying to buy his way into Congress. And Crockett's like, okay, I'll do it. And I really, at this point, just wanted the singing group to come back in and be like, Davy Crockett abandoned his family. Because seriously, this scene is the last you hear of his family. Except for kind of in passing at the very end of the movie when he's like, I used to have a wife and beautiful kids, you know. The interesting thing is that historically, Davy Crockett had a second wife and lived very happily with her, the children that she had had from her previous marriage, the children he had had from his previous marriage. They became like a blended family. They ended up having more children with him and his second wife. I mean, it's really not portrayed as it was in the thing. And he was home when his wife died, apparently. And he had even invited his brother and sister-in-law to come stay with them and help out with the children and help him care for his wife and stuff toward the end. It was a bit better, I guess, than the movie portrays it. He wasn't, like, he didn't just, like, go like, well, I used to have a family, but they're living with somebody else now. Back to bachelor life, which is kind of the way the movie portrays it. It's really awkward.
And they kind of mention in passing that this corrupt judge is trying to get Bigfoot out of prison.
Yeah, that's also the last time we hear about. He was the lawyer who tried to get Bigfoot acquitted. And now he's trying to be a congressman. So Davey's like, all right, you know, let's do it. And he puts on his buckskins and his coonskin cap and he goes around with his kind of populist, you know, aw shucks, you know, I ain't one for much learning, but I know right from wrong, and that man over there is a two-bit scoundrel, you know.
It feels like his entire political career, at least as it is portrayed in this movie, is that he's smarter than he puts himself on, but he has people expect a certain personality from him, so he has to act in that personality.
Yeah, and as he's in the middle of his campaign, he gets invited to go meet with Andrew Jackson, who is now running for president. And Andrew Jackson's like, you really need to up your game here. You need to win this because that guy's going to be no good for Tennessee or for the nation. And he tells Davy, there's books being written about you. And he shows Davy a book, and it turns out that the book has been written by Georgie. Georgie has been writing books about his exploits with Davy.
And exploits that never happened, because Davy said, well, I've never been to the Rocky Mountains. Why is there a story about me? And
yeah.
Later on, he confronts Georgie about it. Say, hey, I didn't mind you telling tall tales and singing songs about me when it was just you and me, but now everyone has to hear this, which means now I gotta wear this buckskin outfit every day and this coonskin cap every day because that's what they expect of me. Like, he's angry about this.
You know, he really does bristle against it. He's like, I'm not that guy. Andrew Jackson basically says, it doesn't matter. You're a legend now, play into that. And so Davey does.
And he eventually go into Congress in a buckskin outfit with a coon hat.
And he's mad at Georgie because Georgie shows up to see him give his first speech as a freshman congressman. And Davey's like, thanks to you and your ridiculous books, now I've got to go on the floor of the House of Representatives and give a speech in my buckskins and my silly hat. You know, in front of a bunch of well-dressed men, you know?
And we do have one scene before this happens where he's actually in a nice suit. Like, he's
yeah,
fully...
When he goes to see Andrew Jackson, he is dressed to the nines. He looks good. He cleans up real well.
You know, he knows that this is what a politician dresses like, and he is fully prepared to dress like a politician in suits and all that. But now he can't.
Yeah.
And he's angry about it. It's anyone who has a public persona when you're expected to be that public persona 24/7.
Yeah, in real life, Davy Crockett was, by this point, a businessman. He owned several businesses. He was, of course, you know, he did fight in wars. He was a hunter and stuff, you know. That part is true, but... by this point in his life, he was mainly just a businessman, so that he wouldn't have been dressed like that all the time. You know, that's the stuff you go hunting in. You know, that's your camo that you go hunting in. But thanks to Georgie, now he's got to play into that. Aw shucks, I'm the king of the wild frontier. You know, it's
so yeah. By this point, it's 1927, so we skipped a bit here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and Crockett, in his coonskin, sitting in Congress, going, all shucks, I'm just a simple man, but I know right from wrong. And he makes jokes about being a country boy, which makes everybody laugh.
But he's well-liked, and one of the things he does in this first speech is he says, I know that I'm going to stand with our new president, Andrew Jackson. He is all in for Andrew Jackson at this point. And Jackson invites him over, and all after Davey's been in Congress for a little bit, and Jackson has been in...
So his second term as president, yeah.
Yeah. So this is a couple of years into their respective terms, I believe. And they have a meeting at the White House, and Davey says, I'm not really liking all this wining and dining you're doing with businessmen, and you know, it's kind of the same thing we have today. Like, there's been a lot of what we would now call lobbyists coming in to see Jackson, and Jackson has started saying some stuff that Davey finds a little concerning, which is stuff about American expansionism, how we should kick the natives off their land, how maybe a treaty with a native isn't as good as a treaty with a white man, and we're free to break it as much as we want. And Davey's like, no, that's not how we play. You know, like, we made a treaty, they signed in good faith.
We gotta be men of our word.
Yeah, we need to keep our word or we're the bad guys here. And Andrew Jackson's like, yeah, but does it matter if we own all the land and kill all the people who would say otherwise? Because that sounds awesome to me.
Even going as far as to say, you're a good man, Crockett. Jackson is almost ending his second term, and they want Crockett to run for president.
Yeah, so they send him out on this kind of goodwill tour, and he's traveling all over giving speeches and putting on his coonskin cap and, you know...
in character completely. But this turns out to all be a distraction. Because on the floor of Congress, they're setting up an eviction bill to get rid of all the natives off the land. Knowing that Crockett opposes this idea. They wanted to get him out of Washington so he's not there when the vote happens.
And remember, this law wasn't subtle. It was literally called the Indian Removal Act. I mean, Jackson was not, he was not subtle about his intention toward the natives. And for those of you who don't know, up until very recently, most people would have called Andrew Jackson the most horrible president we've ever had in the nation's history because of mainly all the genocide, which kind of started with the Indian Removal Act, which led to, have I mentioned the genocide? Because I feel like that's super important to this story.
Yeah.
But Georgie hears about the genocide bill coming to Congress, and he gets on the fastest horse he can find and rides and rides and rides, and is like, Davy, you need to get your butt back to Washington, because they're trying to pull a fast one on you. Because by the rules of Congress, and honestly, this is still the rules of Congress to this day, the rules aren't, you know, you need X number of the full elected officials. You just need X number of whoever is there on the day. So this was actually a tactic that got used, I wouldn't say often, but it was a known tactic to try to push legislation through when a massive opponent of it would not be there. And Georgie realizes they're pulling a fast one. He shows up and he's like, Davy, grab a horse. We are riding back to D.C. without stopping.
So at this point, it's, what is it, 1830? So, yeah, Indian Removal Act of 1830. Okay.
Yeah.
So he goes there. He makes this big speech that pretty much says, we made a promise to these people. And we can't break it.
Yeah. The interesting thing, and this was the point when I was like, ooh, this movie is so more, you know, for a movie that starts out with a disclaimer of, oops, we did a racism, sorry about that. This is a super woke movie for 1955, and I want to give it all of the credit for that.
I think the warning was just for the portrayal of natives with the...
Well, it really is the first act.
Yeah, yeah.
The portrayal of natives in that first act is very much, these are the bad guys we're fighting against. However, the context of the entire movie shows the actual historical reality, which was that Davy Crockett, with all his flaws, I'm not saying he was a perfect saint or anything, but as far as, you know, white male politicians in the 1800s in the U.S. go, he really did fight for the rights of the natives and for upholding these treaties. And the speech that he gives has one of the best lines, which is where he says that you should not look down on these people because they are uneducated in our ways. He doesn't say that they're uneducated. He doesn't say that they're savage, which would have been the normal talking point at the time.
Doesn't call them stupid.
He doesn't call them stupid. He doesn't say that they are lesser, just that their ways are not our ways, and that they are not educated in our ways, and we are not educated in theirs.
And this, historically, this was not popular.
Not at all. Jackson was relatively popular at the time, especially with politicians, and going against Jackson is basically what ended Davy Crockett's political career, honestly.
Yeah, career suicide right then and there. It wasn't even popular among the people in Tennessee, as he was defeated the next year, and exile, you know, that was the end of his political career.
Yeah, he ended up losing this battle. The movie makes it seem like I won the battle, but in reality, he really did lose this battle. I mean, the act passed, we did all the genocide. Seriously, don't forget that we did the genocide. That is very important for this story, but Davy actually did his best to stand against it. and spoke against it pretty much for the rest of his life. He ran for office again and kind of won again for a little bit and then lost for a little bit. So he had a very contentious career, but this is what really ended it. He was on the up and up. Like we said, they were looking at him to be president and all that kind of stuff. And what the U.S. was doing to the natives just kind of broke his faith in the system, it looks like. That's kind of the end of Act 2. And we go into Act 3 learning that basically now that Davy is disillusioned with American politics and with Andrew Jackson specifically, awful, awful man that he was, he decides, I hear there's some stuff going down in Texas and that they're fighting for freedom and that they may need some help. So I'm going to go to San Antonio.
1836, the Battle of the Alamo.
Yep. Georgie decides to come with him. Just because. Historically, I think George Russell was already dead at this point. So he wasn't at the Battle of the Alamo, I believe. But they head off to Texas, and before they leave, there's this, really weird, over-the-top riverboat gambler who's there, who just goes like, I want to come along to Texas too, and they kind of look at him and they're like, no, I don't think you really have it in you to brave the wilds of Texas, and he's like, no, I'm coming with you, and they're like, okay. Seriously, I have no idea why this character is here. It is the most bizarre addition to this story.
Again, the TV version might expand it, but we're going by what is in the movie.
Yeah, it's the only thing that's on Disney Plus right now, so, you know, it's kind of what we have to go with. But the movie basically doesn't really explain why this dude wants to go to Texas. It's just this really posh British Ponzi kind of gambler.
He's definitely coded. Like, he's definitely coded a certain way.
He's super queer coded. But he wants to go in all of his fancy laces and brocades and stuff, and you know, eventually Davy and Georgie are just like, yeah, okay, whatever, you'll probably die on the way. We're not going to stop to bury you. Come along if you want.
So they finally reach Texas, and they end up seeing a buffalo stampede being chased by this one Cherokee man.
Comanche.
Hmm?
Comanche.
Okay, thank you. Comanche man. And unfortunately, he's not looking where he's riding, and his horse trips over a gopher hole.
Prairie dogs, yeah.
And the
interesting thing is that Davy sees it come and he's like, he's about to go into the prairie dog, and down he goes. And there's this great little bit where they just insert this nature footage of a prairie dog coming out of his hole and basically looking like, what do you want? You come into my house, I'm going to injure your horse. Go away.
Like, is he dead? It's almost like the guy comes like, is he dead?
But go over there to try to help the Comanche warrior that has now taken a tumble from his horse. And he fights at first because, I mean, honestly, I don't blame him. You know, it's like,
if you're a Native American man and you see this white guy touching you, Yeah,
a lone Comanche, and suddenly he's surrounded by three white men who are grabbing at him, you know. But eventually he kind of passes out from his injuries, and Davy takes him over and sets him down on a bedroll, and they make food for him and everything.
They dress his wounds.
Yeah, dress his wounds. And before he comes to, Davy's like, well, you know, if he ever comes to, he'll be a good guide. And Georgie immediately is like, your really smart guide just like, plowed his horse through a prairie dog den, so maybe not the best. But the guy comes to, and they communicate in a form of sign language.
Yep, and they nickname him Busted Luck because, well, he kind of has some bad luck.
Yeah, he tells them this whole story about he was never able to take a scalp in battle, so he's not, like, officially a warrior. And also, he had a really pretty wife, but the medicine man took a liking to her, and so they sent him away from the tribe so that the medicine man could marry his wife. And then he was gonna, like, get his way back into the tribe by killing a buffalo and bringing it back, and then, you know, he ended up where we found him. You know, that's what he was trying to do. And so they end up naming him Busted Luck because that is a really sad sob story.
So yeah, they end up traveling together, the four of them. They meet a Mexican family who kind of tells him not to go. They even pray for him.
Yeah, they tell him that Santa Ana has taken over the whole area of San Antonio, and that all of the Texas soldiers are holed up in a little mission called the Alamo. So Davy's like, Alamo, that sounds like a wonderful place. Let's go vacation there.
They should go in the basement and find Pee Wee Herman's bicycle. but yeah, the Mexican family is pretty much telling them not to go. They're going anyway. They kind of do a little prayer for the gringos who are going to surely die.
Yeah, they're immediately praying for them, like, bless these idiot white men who are going off to die.
Yeah, they bless the white man, but not the native with them.
I guess.
Anyway. Yeah, they and as they're getting to the animal, they're chased by the Santa Ana army.
Yeah, and the men inside the Alamo very quickly realize that there's at least some reinforcements because they're being chased by Mexican soldiers and shot at. So they're like, quick, open the doors, let them in, you know, fire back. And they're able to drive back the soldiers and let in the group of four here that Davy has. And they tell Davy, they're like, our commander, our colonel, Jim Bowie.
Creator of the Bowie knife.
Yeah, and which is what Davy immediately says. The guy that invented that knife, and they're like, yeah, that one. Bowie had been injured, and this is historically accurate. He had been injured at this point and was basically being taken care of in a back room, but he was still leading the defense and was still in charge. And Davy comes in and he's like, we're here to help. And he's like, great, how many men have you brought? And he's like, well, there's four of us. And he's like, no, we need like 20,000 men to, like, you know, to do this thing. Like, he names some ridiculous number of men. And he's like, no, we need a lot of men to defend this thing. And he's like, well, you got the four of us. So this whole last part of the movie is just the Battle of the Alamo from this point on. That's like the first kind of 10 minutes of this segment, and the rest of it is the actual battle itself. Santa Ana sends troops forward with cannons. They're able to hold off the cannons.
In this version of events, the Spanish army does give the Americans a chance to surrender. But it's under really bad terms. So the Americans escalate the fight. They start shooting at him.
Yeah, and there's a lot of advance retreat for the Mexican army. They try to scale the walls at one point and are driven back. And you can tell, you know, for such a short movie that devotes such a short amount of time to this actual battle, they really portray the siege very well. You get the sense of they're running low on supplies, you know, they barely have any food. They are running low on gunpowder. In fact, they stop firing the cannons because it takes up way more gunpowder. And they're saving it for the rifles and the pistols. they at one point send Georgie out to go to a nearby town and beg for reinforcements. And they're able to cover him under, you know, darkness and distract enough for him to get away. Several days later, he comes back and he's like, they're sending nobody. We're not getting a single person.
And he's all cut up and his entire body's cut up. He's got scars on his face from the Mexicans attacking him.
And Davey is like, why did you come back? Why, you know, you were out. You made it to safety. You knew that they weren't sending anybody back. You knew the situation was hopeless. Why didn't you just go and live your life? And Georgie's like, well, you know, you're my best friend and we're bros being dudes or whatever.
He's not going to abandon his best friend.
Yeah. And so they break the news to Jim Bowie and they're like, this is all you get. This is it. And Bowie and Crockett immediately realize, like, well, this is a hopeless situation. So they go out to the troops, they gather the troops, and they're like, we're not getting any reinforcements, we're not getting any supplies, this is what we've got. And they draw a line in the sand, and they're like, anybody that wants to slip out, it's nighttime. He's like, anybody that wants to slip out and try to make it to safety, nobody will think the less of you. Go home to your families. And not a single person abandons.
Yeah, even Thimbling, our gambling man, yes, he is the last man to cross the line, but he's like, I guess he's in too deep. He's just gonna, you'd think he would run, but he doesn't.
Yeah. But every single person ends up staying. Jim Bowie has people carry him across the line because he's on a stretcher, near death anyway. And so they reinforce as best they can, and they await the oncoming Mexican army, and they sing a song.
Farewell to the Mountains, which actually was written by Davy Crockett himself.
Yeah, it was a poem, and then the same person who wrote the music to Ballad of Davy Crockett, he wrote music to this poem. And Fess Parker does sing it. He's got a really good voice. Apparently his early audition for Walt Disney was just he walked into Walt Disney's office with a guitar, sang a song, and walked out. So this is them getting him his pipes on display here. And it's beautiful. This is really effective and moving scene.
All of the soldiers start singing along. It's like they know that this is the end for them and they're going to stick together.
Yeah, this is their last night, basically. And it really is, because the next morning at dawn, Santa Ana attacks, and this time breaches the gates of the mission. And we see Busted Luck getting killed. We see Thimble Rig go down. We see Bowie go down. We see a few of the other soldiers that we've met go down. George ends up dying, trying to help Davey light a cannon. And Davey is the last one alive, and we see him swarmed by Mexican troops as he fights on and on. And then we cut to a title card about the brave soldiers and remembering the Alamo. And that's where we end our movie, folks.
The spirit will grow as long as we remember the Alamo is the final verse of this song.
Yeah.
And that's how the movie ends, which begs the question, how did they do a sequel if he died?
Well, it was a prequel, midquel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was before the Battle of the Alamo.
Let's let's get our final thoughts on this one. What did you think of this as a movie and as a historical piece?
Well, as a historical piece, it's back and forth. And all movies are going to be like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's really possible to make a 100% historically accurate movie about any event.
It wouldn't make a very good movie.
Yeah, most history does not, would not film well. I mean, honestly, it's just, you know, most of this would just be like, you know, any, you know, talk to any soldier who's been in an actual battle and they're like, most of it is just sitting around waiting. And then you have like, you know, an hour or two where a bunch of stuff happens and then you go back to waiting again. Given that, most of the stuff that they have as big points in his life are relatively accurate. Mm-hmm. Going into this film, I'm going to say that I am not a general fan of Westerns. I personally find the entire genre to be slightly problematic. A lot of it based on American expansionism and exceptionalism. A lot of racist portrayals of natives, of course. However, I was really shocked by the rather kind, and like I said, this is a very woke movie for 1955. And I really liked that, except for in the first part of the movie where they were very clearly, you know, we are at war with these people and so we dehumanize them the way we do any people when we are at war. I thought that it was kind of interesting that they tried to treat the native tribes with respect. Mm-hmm. They did show that Davy Crockett was absolutely opposed to the more hideous things that Andrew Jackson did. It was fascinating to me on that level. As far as a movie on its own, just as entertainment, much like Mighty Ducks, this is a movie that I have seen. I found it a little more interesting than Mighty Ducks, but will this be a movie that I watch a lot? No.
I can see why this was popular, especially at the time.
Oh yeah, this was the perfect movie for the time.
Yeah. And I actually, I agree with you that that this is a lot more... a lot more woke than most films of the time, especially you wouldn't really expect this from Disney of all people.
Yeah, given the treatment of natives in other Disney properties around this time, some of which we have talked about before.
Given how Walt was known as a very rah-rah America F yeah kind of guy. To do a movie about a guy who questioned the moral fiber of America. It's strange that, and for that to become such a popular character, such a popular film.
And you know, everything I had heard about this film just kind of in the cultural thing was very much like, yeah, Davy Crockett, he goes out and he shoots Indians, you know, which is a word they use a lot. Mm-hmm. Which now we would find it offensive. However, at the time this was set in, that was kind of the nice term.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, language does evolve. And so we can't always judge the use of certain terms by today's standards. However, it is interesting that all the really vile terms for natives that would have been used at the time are sometimes used by other characters in the movie, but never by Crockett himself or by Georgie. Mm-hmm. Which I kind of like. You don't have any denigrating savage talk or anything from our two main heroes here. No, I really kind of respect this movie for what it is. Or the series, I guess I should say. As a movie, I think it might fail a little bit from the movie loaf kind of perspective. I might be interested in seeing the full uncut miniseries to see how that originally would have played on TV. Perhaps they will restore that and put it up eventually. It does feel very chopped and formed. In this one, not as bad as the Zorro one.
Mm-hmm.
I think Zorro was worse about it. Just kind of like, what happened to that plot line and where did these characters come from? It flows a little bit better in Davy Crockett. They do a better job of stitching it together. And of course, the song, as insufferable earwormy as it is, really does help to fill in some of those gaps. So, to answer our big question at the end of every film, I can still see the magic people saw in this. I'm not sure if it carries the same magic for today's audience as some of them do. But I think if you look at it as a historical piece of this is what Disney was doing at the time, this is where America kind of was as a nation, this is what kids of the time, especially young boys, would have been exposed to, you know, and built their schoolyard play and stuff around. I think it's really fascinating bit of Disney history and American history. And it's an okay movie.
Agreed. It's okay. As if there being magic in here. I'm going to say yes, there is some magic in here, and I could see the magic from the time. I found more entertainment of the second act of just this guy who just wants to do the right thing, even if it isn't the popular idea, such as going against the eviction of the natives.
And second act really shines. I agree with you.
Yeah. So I think that's all we can really say about Davy Crockett. It's an okay film. It's not going to be on either one of our best Disney movies of all time list.
But yeah, if anything we've said has like piqued your interest, I would say it's worth giving it a watch.
Watch it at least once. Yeah. I think. You know. Yeah. So let's move on to what we're talking about next week. It's the movie that started a million furry fandoms, Robin Hood.
Oodle-lolly, oodle-lolly, golly, what a film.
So join us next week as we go to Disney's Robin Hood, and we will talk to you all then. Bye!
Bye! Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.